Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, discussion, dialogue, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your calls and emails. What more could you ask for on a beautiful Saturday morning? And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. It's been an interesting week. The story by far of the week is a very well-worded press release that made front page news and also a lot of media hype about a new blood test that can improve cancer screening. Well, actually, when you drill down, it's not quite a new blood test. It's a technological merger, shall we say, between Johnson & Johnson, who's going to ante up some money, and another company, Biomicroelectromechanical Systems. And what they're going to do is put together a commercial test that will allow a doctor to draw your blood and look for cancer cells. Now, something that many of us were surprised to learn a few years ago was that in a person who has cancer, whether it's been diagnosed or not, and whether it's metastasized or not, and that's very odd, you can find circulating cancer cells. And that has prognostic value as far as how many cells you've got. But more importantly, let's suppose that I identify a lung cancer in a patient. Now, some lung cancers respond very well to certain kinds of chemotherapy, and others not at all. So wouldn't it be nice if I could have some of those cancer cells and know that they're going to respond to chemotherapy? Well, I can do that from the primary tumor. But if the person has secondary tumors, which are where I'm mainly targeting the chemo, they may have mutated further and be chemo resistant. So for the last few years in Europe, certain laboratories have run cancer cell analysis and take your cancer cells from your blood, find them, screen them for sensitivity to the various chemotherapeutic agents that might be being used in standard chemo, and find out whether or not your cells contain mutations that make them less vulnerable and would argue for using a different agent. That's really where these tests have their clinical utility. They also have some prognostic value in that if we find a solid tumor in someone, let's say a breast cancer, and we run blood and we find no breast cancer cells in their bloodstream, well, that's positive prognostic finding. If we find, let's say, greater than 5 cells per deciliter in their bloodstream, then that means that this cancer, or at least portions of that cancer, have the property of being able to peel off, lose adhesion, and get into the bloodstream. Well, that's step one in spreading. Whether those cells actually have the power to take root and thrive in another environment is an open question. And this test doesn't answer that question. So the way the press releases went, it was going to be a screening test. Imagine someday you walk into the doctor's office and they draw your blood and they tell you, oh, you've got cancer. I think we've got a long way to go before we actually have that kind of screening. And the problem will become, if you screen out positive, how accurate is that positive? And does it in fact represent a cancer that your body has going to vanquish, or a cancer that will never kill you? Like the problem with discovering prostate cancer in men whose life expectancy is much less than the amount of time it'll take the cancer to grow and hurt them. We may find that early detection, particularly indiscriminate early detection, doesn't advance our cause, because cancer is a series of mutational events which occur, and whether or not that cancer is able to grow and thrive depends both on the mutations of the individual cancer cells and also on the defenses of the person in question. We've sort of thought of people as being this passive soil, and the cancer is like seeds that get planted in the soil. That's certainly the conventional medical view. But actually, much research supports the idea that you can do a great deal in terms of your lifestyle and behavior to improve the, well, let's just say, the anti-weed functioning of that soil, such that a cancer cell, even if it finds itself in the right place at the right time with the right set of mutations to conceivably take root and grow, does not manage to do so because your immune system is too powerful for it and overcomes it before it can get going. I would like to see us put a lot more of research and emphasis into not finding the cancer as much as shoring up the natural defenses which keep us from succumbing to cancer. In just a few days, Congress starts up. It's going to be Wednesday, and we know what we're going to hear. Lots and lots of sound bites, and already announced a full frontal assault by the new Republican majority in the legislature against the healthcare finance reform package that passed last year. Now, what happened at the election was that the Democrats just did not want to have that debate. Now, I think we're going to hear much more, many more sound bites and many more press releases about what's positive about healthcare reform. If you've been a listener here, then you know that people with pre-existing conditions, such as a woman who had breast cancer 20 years ago, can no longer be denied insurance. Senior citizens are now not going to fall into the donut hole that was brought to you by, I might add, a Republican majority in the House and the Senate. And we're also going to hear a lot of misinformation. And I have one thing to say about that. I've gotten to the point where if I hear it on Fox News, I want to see it fact-checked. I've gotten to the point where if a Republican commentator or a conservative commentator gets up and says something, I immediately want to go fact-check it. I had a friend like this in high school. We all knew about her. She was always full of stories. She had these great tales of her adventures or interesting or fun things that had happened or what was going on. And most of it was nonsense. She was a pathological liar. And if she told you that so-and-so was dating so-and-so, well, you better fact-check that because it probably wasn't true. It was interesting and salacious and it stuck in your mind and it was probably nonsense. So basically, take a deep breath. Don't believe what you hear from the left or the right, fact check it. But especially if it sounds really good and really catchy and you hear it four or five places from the right, it's nonsense. Fact check it. It's the story of the day. And they are very good at planting these insidious anti-information malaprop type memes in our culture. They are champions at it. And you have to fact check everything they say. It's as simple as that. Okay, this email from Lauren in New York. Preventing digestive illness while traveling is the subject. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I love your show, and I'm a regular podcast listener. I'll be traveling to Morocco next month, and I'm worried about getting sick from foodborne or waterborne bacteria. I've heard this is inevitable, but is there anything I can do to prevent this from happening, such as taking a course of probiotics before and during the trip? If so, what kind, how much, and how often should I take them? Thanks for your help and all the hard work you do. Well, Lauren, I'm happy to answer your question. Probiotics are a piece of preventing traveler's diarrhea or foodborne illnesses. But it isn't the whole piece. For one thing, traveling to a place where there is a lot of hepatitis A, I would recommend having hepatitis A vaccinations. Salmonella typhi, another foodborne illness, call it a poop-to-mouth disease, just to graphicalize it, is something else that there are vaccinations for, and I do recommend that if a person is adventure traveling. Now, most foodborne illness actually comes from the hands. So washing your hands immediately before eating is absolutely critical. So touching an elevator button, a banister, a pen, the back of the chair when you sit down to eat, got to use that hand sterilizer. It's really, really important. For prevention in terms of probiotics, I recommend a mixed probiotic product, something that contains at least two species of lactobacillus and two species of bifidobacterium, and about 10 to 12 billion organisms, and one or two of those capsules a day. That's just background. You should, if you develop a diarrhea, use much, much larger doses of the probiotics, perhaps three or four capsules three or four times a day, and that will really nip the diarrhea in the bud in most cases. Pepto-Bismol tablets are also a really useful thing if you don't have a contraindication to aspirin because they do contain salicylic acid. The Pepto-Bismol tablets taken just before you eat a questionable meal, I keep them in reserve for when I get invited to someone's house, which is not to insult the host. I'm going to go and I'm going to eat. But when I eat in that house, the germs in that house, that household is adapted for. I'm not adapted for. And some of them will get into the food. I need to have a little bit of something in my tummy, and the bismuth in the Pepto-Bismol does a good job of sterilizing what I'm eating and discouraging those bacteria that I'm taking in from getting a foothold. And then, of course, there are the usual Peace Corps type precautions. Peel it, boil it, fry it, or forget it. Anything that's at a buffet table that doesn't have steam rising from it, forget it, because the flies that land on it have contaminated it. Peeling the vegetables, peeling the fruit. If it's not hot when it comes to you and you can't peel it, that doesn't get eaten. So lettuce and a lot of salad things out the window. And don't forget, no ice, because of course the water that the ice is made of, you may be putting your dirty ice into nice clean water. So hope that helps. We're going to Anonymous, who is on line one. Hello, Anonymous. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm still sick with the flu. It's an awful flu. People, wash your hands when you go shopping.
Yes, indeed.
My goodness, it's a terrible flu. But at any rate, I've been spending 15, 20 hours of sleep. And the last two nights, I've been waking up with my eyes stuck together. And so have somehow I've contacted another disease.
No, probably what you have done is taken the disease in your nose, blown your nose, and then wiped your eyes with the tissue because they were watering a little bit from the sneezing, and transmitted the virus to your eyes.
Oh.
The sticky eye thing is usually viral conjunctivitis, when you wake up and the eyes are kind of glued together. I haven't seen this kind of glue. When I was a kid, you used to be able to buy this sort of glue in a brown bottle with a pink rubber tip.
I remember.
And when you dripped it on something, it would have that same kind of yellow crusty quality. And it would dry out and you could brush it off, would get on your fingers and crust off. And it's almost exactly what you get on your eyelids when you have a viral conjunctivitis. So if that's ringing a bell, sometimes it can be gluier. But when a person has stuff that looks like what comes out of the inside of a pimple in their eye, then they've got a bacterial infection. Mm. So if it's watery and red and crusty, it's usually viral. And in the context of someone who's had a viral illness, the nasal pharynges gets infected, is shedding virus, and it's really easy to transfer that to the eyes. That's a benign self-limited lesion, rarely causes any trouble. Contact lens wearers, however, should get their contacts go into the box and do not get used. And if you can't sterilize the contacts because they're disposables, then dispose of them, because the virus will sit in the contact lenses and you'll re-inoculate yourself.
Okay. Second question.
Yes.
I haven't been taking my meds, because some of my medication says take with food, and I haven't eaten anything for about 5 days. So I'd like you to talk about why it's bad to stop your medication. I went through this nausea phase, and everything I put into my stomach came up. So I just gave up trying to take meds, and they're maintenance things.
Yeah, it depends on what the meds are. So, for example, this wouldn't be true for thyroid meds, because, of course, they don't take with food. But if a person, let's say, is a diabetic and they're not eating, then sometimes they're better off not using their diabetic meds. If they are a type 1 diabetic, it gets very tricky when they stop eating. And in fact, that's one of the problems with insulin in general, is that you have to calculate it against what the person's taking in. And if you don't know what that person's going to be taking in, that can be quite problematic. And with something like insulin, you need to work closely with your doctor and have a sick plan, which we generally put in place for people on insulin. But in your case, blood pressure medicine, what are we talking about? What kind of meds?
The Losartan I've managed to take.
Okay, that's blood pressure. What was the one that's maintenance that you haven't taken?
The estradiol and Prometrium and the vitamin D.
Okay, so vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. It's stored in your body tissues. You've got reserve, so that's not a big deal if you don't take that for a couple of weeks. Estradiol is a hormone. So if you don't take it at all, then you might get some hot flashes.
I've been expecting hot flashes, but I'm just cold all the time.
Right. So a lot of the medications are for long-term prevention, and if you don't take them for a week while your physiology is disrupted, it doesn't matter. a lot of times when people aren't eating, they're also not drinking, and their blood pressure drops anyway.
I have been struggling to drink enough.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So do you have a blood pressure cuff?
No.
All right. That's something I do recommend for anyone with hypertension, because you can monitor at home if you have to stop your medicines. And if your blood pressure is going really high, then you're going to have to take them even if you're not taking them with food. As you said, you've been on the losartan. But for the most part, there are only a few medications that if you stop them, something bad will happen to you immediately. Clonidine, which is used for blood pressure, is one of those medications where if you stop it abruptly, you get rebound hypertension.
Mm.
And so I'm often, if a person in that situation who's on that would not be able to eat, I would put a patch with the drug on them while they were having problems, because I wouldn't want to abruptly withdraw the drug. But most pharmaceuticals won't do that. And if you do withdraw a drug and get a side effect, like some kind of discontinuation syndrome like one might get with Paxil, usually taking it outside of the way it's supposed to be taken, like if it's take with food and you take it on an empty stomach and keep it down for an hour, you'll get enough of it in to prevent those discontinuation side effects.
Mm-hmm.
You won't get the full dose, but you'll get enough to prevent a sort of withdrawal phenomenon.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
All right. I'm sorry you're having, you know, such difficulty. And let me share with you and the rest of the audience that there is a Chinese herbal, general Chinese herbal medication for wind invasion, which is called Yin Qiao, Y-I-N-Q-I-A-O. And I heard about this back when I was studying acupuncture from one of the professors, and I'm like, yeah, sure. But it really has become my go-to drug when I have any kind of hoarseness or cough, and you sound like you've got both. So
yeah.
You might head out to the health food store and try that herb.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck to you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Dave in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the program.
So I have this really strange problem. I sweat heavily. I always have, but it seems to be getting worse lately. I'll be sitting in a meeting at work, for example, and it seems to be tied with tension. And I'll start getting, you know, as the tension rises, I'll start sweating more. And sometimes just even a minimal amount of activity causes me to sweat heavily. And I'm wondering if there's anything herbal that I could take. And I also have a hypothesis, and that is that I've been a runner my entire life. And about 3 months ago, I quit running because of an injury. And I'm wondering if there's any connection there.
Oh, I think there probably is. When a person sweats, this is physiological arousal sort of thing. It's triggered by adrenaline. It is literally opening up the blood vessels that go to the sweat glands. And the sweat glands are like these filters. And so if you send more blood through them, they filter more fluid and out it comes as sweat. There's literally like a train switching in terms of where the blood goes that determines this. And the things that trigger this shunting of blood to the skin are often related to hormones. So very classically, when women go through menopause and their estrogen levels drop, their threshold for shunting blood to the skin erratically goes up, and the classic hot flash is the result. You're not a female and you're not going through menopause, but you have undergone a major physiologic shift with
right.
having been a runner and now not being a runner. And I have a feeling that there's a strong connection there. And it may also relate to the fact that your basic sympathetic tone, your level of arousal, is starting out higher than it used to. So in the morning, before you even get out of bed, you've got essentially a higher level of sympathetic tone, a higher level of adrenaline arousal in your system. And then anything that comes that adds to that, any alerting response, any fight or flight type stress response, is taking you up to the sweating threshold.
Okay, the other thing I should add is I quit drinking coffee a couple months ago, too.
So another physiologic change that could be related. Remember, these are hormonal influences on a threshold, kind of like a capacitor. You know, I don't know how much electronics you know, but...
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, so you have to charge up the capacitor fully before it's going to kick over. And then once it's charged, it discharges across the gap and then starts charging back up again. And if you think of the charging of the capacitor having multiple influences and the capacitor firing, making you sweat, then if you have a change in your caffeine consumption, that's going to affect how your body, your enzymes are going to change in your liver, because caffeine is a stimulant for the cytochrome A1A. And that's going to affect how you metabolize other drugs, and it's going to affect how you metabolize possibly even your own adrenaline.
Yeah, so that's the main reason I stopped drinking coffee, is because whenever I drank coffee, I started to sweat.
Okay, but that's a stimulant too. I mean, you can have a primary effect in that the coffee's making you sweat because your threshold for sweating's higher, but then that can feed forward also on how you break down other things. But that doesn't happen for months, so it gets really complicated to figure out cause and effect here. But I'm assuming that your injury is temporary and you're going to be able to get back to running?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
The other thing is, when someone suddenly starts having a major physiologic shift like this, depending on their age and what the probabilities are, if they're 25, I don't hunt as hard as if they're 50. But if they're 50, you know, I want to see what their blood pressure is doing. I want to see if they've developed an adrenal tumor, which is rare, by the way. I want to see if they've developed sleep apnea, which is not rare and can definitely cause physiologic shifts like this. And I want to look into maybe they need to do some stress reduction. So in terms of advice for this, until you can start running again, I think you need to find a way of toning down your adrenaline every day in the morning before you go to work.
And well, I've been taking valerian root.
That's nice. It'll help you sleep, but I don't think that's going to do the trick for this.
Okay.
You know, I don't think this is in a pill, quite honestly. I think where you want to look is in deep breathing, meditation, yoga with pranayama, which is the breathing kind of yoga,
right.
Tai Chi, Qigong, something that gets you taking slow, deep diaphragmatic breaths, because that will raise your parasympathetic tone and help balance the sympathetic tone. If you like devices, if you're, you know, kind of a techie person,
yeah,
there's a device called the Respirate, R-E-S-P-E-R-A-T-E.
Yeah, and, okay.
Right, and it's, you know, it's a couple $100 device that basically coaches you to do deep belly breathing. And I use it on my hypertensive patients who want to avoid drugs, because it's got good solid studies showing that it lowers blood pressure. We do know this, so it's like, okay, well, try the device. And if you do it conscientiously 15 minutes a day, you do get a lowering of blood pressure. And I use it also for people who are just edgy, and it works quite well. The other thing is, there's a company called In Search of the Wild Divine that has a nice software program that effectively does the same thing. They use galvanic skin response. So you have a little thing on your finger that checks your level of arousal by looking at the electrical capacity of your skin, which is sort of what they do in a lie detector test, which is, by the way, looking at perspiration. So it's directly related to your issue.
Okay. I'm absolutely amazed at how much knowledge you have in your head.
You know, I have no more knowledge in my head than the next person. I have a God-given talent, or an evolution, Darwin-given talent, I don't know. Anyway, I have a talent for retrieval. I think it's not how much is in there, but it's how fast I can pull it out that perhaps makes me able to do this program.
Okay.
I'm very grateful. And I hope that I'm putting it to good use, you know, using my talents for the force, so to speak.
Oh, definitely. You make me look forward to Saturday mornings even more than I normally would.
Oh, well, if I can get anybody to listening to the radio at 9 o'clock on Saturday mornings, I figure that's quite a lot of devotion right there. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. We had an off-air caller who wanted to weigh in on what I said earlier. He says heart math is a good stress-based reduction program. It's a local outfit. In fact, there's an interview in the archives about HeartMath, and they use, similar to the program that I was talking about, the Wild Divine program. And yes, I do believe that's a very good program. They're all roughly about the same cost. You know, it'll cost you a couple $100s to do any of these things. But, you know, if you think in terms of viewing that instead of a drug, far better use of your money, if you ask me. Okay, and we had an off-air question. What do I think about the HCG diet? This is a diet involving injecting human chorionic gonadotropin and eating 500 calories per day. Well, a couple of things. First of all, this is a very, very old diet. I remember reading about it in Jacqueline Suzanne's Valley of the Dolls, which was a book about, you know, movie stars in Hollywood using a lot of barbiturates, but they also had to be thin. And one of the diets that was described there was injecting the urine from pregnant women, which is chock full of human chorionic gonadotropin, as a weight loss device. Okay, if you eat 500 calories a day, you will lose weight. I'm not sure if adding HCG necessarily makes you lose more weight. And any kind of rapid weight loss is ill-advised, because it's going to kick over physiologic adaptive mechanisms, you're going to go methylate the wrong DNA when you yo-yo diet. So if you go on a starvation diet, your cells are going to change their DNA, methylate some places, unmethylate others, and set you up to gain more weight when you start eating normally again. Why do that? The more times you go on crash diets, the harder it is to maintain a healthy weight. Your body learns to expect starvation, so it prepares for it. On the other hand, if you want to maintain a healthy weight, the way you do that is you eat frequent, small meals. You don't overload at any given meal. You don't allow yourself to become super hungry because that kicks off regulatory mechanisms. So the worst possible diet is, you know, one meal a day in the evening after fasting all day. It's just a recipe for gaining weight. And I hear it, you know, I don't even eat 1,200 calories a day and I'm not losing weight. And it's like, well, because you're not distributing those calories in a way that works with your physiology. So I have very strong opinions about what healthy eating for weight control looks like, and this ain't it. Furthermore, I have real concerns about what you're doing hormonally to inject a pregnancy hormone into a non-pregnant body, particularly a middle-aged non-pregnant body. The whole concept, whether it speeds the weight loss or not, strikes me as ill-advised and dangerous. So I guess that's my opinion. Let's go to another email. This one from Mark Bernhard, D.C. in Santa Cruz. This was sent last week, but I wanted to read it because I always make a point of reading. If I hear from a doctor, a chiropractor, or a fellow healthcare professional, I always like to acknowledge them. So Mark said, excellent response to the knee injury question just now, but on the subject of proteolytic enzymes, just one addition. The recommended proteolytic enzyme should be taken on an empty stomach. Otherwise, they'll digest your cheeseburger instead of the inflammatory debris. Thank you very much, Mark, for clarifying that. I did forget to mention that, and it's an important point. This from the Medical Breakthroughs by Ivanhoe website, and it's about Medicare patients hospitalized for a stroke die or rehospitalized within a year. And essentially, I won't go into all of the details because this is an analysis of looking at strokes and rehospitalizations using Medicare data. It gives us a baseline for information. And what you want to do with something like this is you want to look at where's the variability. And where you find variability, you want to look at what are the people who are having the low number, the desirable number, doing differently. So on the average, of people who have a stroke, and we're talking ischemic stroke, where a blood clot blocks blood flow to the brain. So ischemic stroke, 30% of people who have one will be dead at the end of a year. Of those, the mortality rate within the first 30 days is about 15%, and the 1 year is 31.1%. This is unadjusted. If you do it for people who get out of the hospital and you just look at if grandma goes home, in other words, and you adjust it there, what you find is that 26% are dead at the end of a year. So what's important here is that if this is your mom who has had a stroke, then the odds are that she'll be back in the hospital in a month with something. That's a 15% odd. And the something most commonly is not another stroke. It's a pneumonia. The reason for that is when you have a stroke, the most common one that people get affects the muscles in the face and throat, and it interferes with a person's ability to protect their airway. There's a lot of sophistication going on in keeping food from going down the wrong way. And when those muscles become uncoordinated, people gasp, choke, and aspirate. Now, we put people on special stroke diets while they're in the hospital, but often they go home and resume their regular diet. And that can lead to aspiration and rehospitalization for pneumonia. So that needs to be looked at as a potential source. Now, the other thing about this is that the best hospitals had a 15% readmission rate, and the worst had a 30% readmission rate. So we need to look at what are the people at the 15% end doing. That's probably the single most valuable thing that you can do with this data. And the other important thing that came out of this study was understanding that still more than half of the people who came to the emergency room with an acute stroke came by personal transportation. That means they came in the car, they sat in the waiting room, the triage nurse looked them over, and then said, oh, yes, we need to take you right back and fast track them, hopefully at that point, to the back of the emergency room. But that's introducing at least a 15, if not a 30 minute delay. And one of the things we do know with strokes is that if we can get the person on a clot buster drug really quickly, we can reverse the damage done by the stroke. And we can, in fact, even sort of retroactively rewind the stroke and have no brain loss, no brain tissue loss. But it has to be done quickly. We have even less time window for a stroke than we do for a heart attack. That means call 911. If your left arm goes limp and your face is drooping, call 911 because you're going to go through the back door of the emergency room. Do not pass go. Do not speak with the triage nurse. And by the time you get to the door, the doctor's going to be looking you over and saying, okay, we need to roll. Where are the thrombolytic drugs? They're going to screen you for, you know, you had a bleeding ulcer last week, so we can't give them to you. And they're going to give them to you if they can, because we know time is of the essence here. So acting promptly if you think you're having a stroke is the number one lesson. The number two lesson is guarding the airway, and aspiration is your big enemy for rehospitalization. And the third lesson is something more subtle, but very, very important. We all have parents who are aging. We all have aunts and uncles and people who are dear to us. And after that stroke, you hear that grandpa had a stroke. You know that mom had a stroke. Start cherishing, because the chances of that person not being with you at the end of a year is 1 out of 3. And that's as good as it gets. And that's nationwide. That's just what the disease does. So now's the time to take those trips to the park, make those extra phone calls, cherish the person, make sure they know they're loved, make sure you, for your own mental health and sanity after they pass, take care of cherishing them and also maybe burying the hatchet if that's where it needs to go. Important information from a seemingly dry epidemiologic study. So we're going now to Jivan in Santa Cruz. How are you?
Good, thank you. I have a question about keeping muscle mass as people get older. I teach yoga. I taught yoga for about 15 years, and I see that women generally around 40 to 45 start losing a certain amount of muscle mass.
Right.
Which doesn't seem to me to be totally necessary, but it just gets killed when they start the diet. Like the body seems to change. It seems like the body seems to change.
The body definitely
eating,
changes.
Yeah, and eating and dieting have to change. The strategies for those seem to have to change, because women seem to start slimming down for their bikinis in the summer. They start losing a lot of their muscle mass.
Exactly.
I'm trying to figure out what to prescribe for that, because, you know, I've worked a long time with some of my lady clients. And
gotcha.
I want them to stay strong and vital.
Okay, well, I am so glad you called, because that's a fabulous opening for some, you know, really important amplification on what I was saying around crash dieting earlier. So let's talk physiologically about what happens in starvation. It'll make sense to you as soon as I get to what the body does here.
Right. Just so you know, that it's not starvation so much as diet. It's just sort of like their whatever method they're dieting. I think they eat enough. It's just sort of like somehow the body's not.
Well, actually, what happens if you don't eat for even 12 hours, which I think a lot of people will go 12 hours without eating,
right,
is a couple of switches get thrown in your physiology. You've got this thing called glycogen, which is an easily mobilized starch, kind of glucose chains in your muscles. That's the whole carbo loading for people who are sprinters or something like that. When you use up your muscle glycogen, it takes about 8 hours to burn through all the glycogen that's stored in your liver and in your muscles. And at that point, the body starts supplying glucose to the brain, particularly, and the heart secondarily, by going into protein. So protein, muscle protein, is the very first place that the body goes. Actually, it's not just muscle protein, it's also protein in the intestines, which is why when people are starved for long periods of times, they end up having trouble digesting food, as they've actually digested part of their own intestine to stay alive. So it's a very interesting paradox. But we start to break down muscle mass very, very, very early, within 12 hours. Now, if you are eating, but you're eating fewer calories, you know, you're trying to get rid of fat, you're trying to get rid of stored fat when you diet, really. But if the components of what you're eating are primarily still carbohydrate, you will still be pulling from the protein. one of the paradoxes of this is that most people's weight reduction diets tend to be lots of vegetables, low fat, and fairly low protein. And when you switch that and flip that and eat a diet that is moderately high protein and high in good fats, you kick over a metabolic switch in the system and you don't start to protein waste. And your connection is very well observed, because when these women diet, physiologically, what they are doing is, instead of going after fat, they're going after muscle. Their bodies are taking from their muscle first, preferentially, and only secondarily from the fat layer. And so you get what's called sarcopenia, what we call a skinny fat person, where their muscle to fat ratio is very unfavorable. They have a lot more fat than muscle. They may look trim, but they're weak. And if you do a CT scan or an MRI of their body, you see really skinny muscles and really big layers of subcutaneous and visceral fat, which is very unhealthy for them.
Yeah, it's pretty, that's what I see. I see this. They're generally roughly the same size, but all of a sudden it's like their vitality or the muscle, their strength starts diminishing, and they get thin around the neck or they get thin around the legs.
And right. Like, no. And it's hard. They start to shake when they're holding the poses, which you would be able to observe in your capacity as a yoga teacher. So how do you prevent that? You prevent that with weight lifting. You have to do resistance exercise, and you have to do a moderately high protein diet. And if you're going to do a high protein diet, you have to drink a lot of water so you get rid of the nitrogen. This is all true. But a high protein diet with reasonably, say, 30% of calories from good fats. These are monounsaturated olive oil, nut oils, and walnuts, olives. Even avocados have a place in a healthy weight loss diet. But it's moderate amounts of fat taken frequently. Every 4 or 5 hours, you're getting some fat and some protein, ideally every 3 hours while awake. And then overnight, what happens is that you live off of the liver glycogen, because the body actually needs glucose constantly dribbling into the system. So you live off your liver glycogen at night, and then in the morning, you eat protein immediately. Then your body starts burning the protein in your stomach rather than the protein in your biceps.
I see.
Because the body's going to burn protein. And it's just a question of, where is it going to get it? If you don't give it to it, it'll take it. And that's
a high protein, low carb, a lot of grains, good fats.
Not a lot of grains.
No, a lot of greens.
Greens, yes. Yeah, a lot of greens. In other words, complex carbohydrates like you find in vegetables are fine. And steak and salmon diet, South Beach diet, Dr. Oz has a diet, You on a Diet is a good diet. There's so many people who have written books. God, there's a diet book out every month, or it seems like every week a new diet book is out. And the good ones all follow, essentially cluster around these principles. Lots of vegetables, moderate fruit, moderate healthy fat, and lots of protein and lots of fluid, and resistance exercise. And the resistance exercise is key. You've got to get them lifting some weights while they're dieting. I don't let anybody go on a diet without lifting weights anymore, because
some people, they do running or something like that, and it seems like they need something more vital.
No, that's not resistance exercise. Essentially, you get what you ask the body to do. If you sit on the couch and use a remote control and drive to work and sit at a computer and use a computer mouse and then go home, you're going to get the body that you ask for here.
Right,
if you're telling your body, I'm not going to give you calories, you need to scavenge protein, the only way that you can keep your muscles from being scavenged is to also say to the body, but I need those muscles because I'm using them every day, so I need you to keep those muscles. Our biggest mistake right now as a culture, as a medical culture, and I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second here, so stand back, is that we do not feed people when we put them in the hospital. We take someone who has a disease, who is hypermetabolic because their immune system is using lots of energy to fight a disease, or they've just been in shock because they've been in a car accident, and they're in a hypermetabolic state. We put them in an intensive care unit. We give them subadequate calories. 4 or 5 days later, when they're still not able to eat, we think about, well, maybe we should give them some peripheral nutrition. But our nutrition supplements are coming too late, and the person has already switched into a hypercatabolic state, and they've scavenged all of their muscle protein. And you see this particularly in old people who are already sarcopenic. They go into the hospital, they're on a ventilator for, let's say, a day, and they've scavenged all the diaphragmatic muscle. They've lost strength in their ability to even breathe because those muscles have been just kicking back and doing nothing, and the body said, oh, free protein, let's grab it. We're so wrongheaded in what we do. We need to be giving people high protein intravenous infusions early in their hospitalization, and that doesn't even exist. It's total heresy to even suggest such a thing in a hospital setting right now, and it's going to be a while before that changes, and it's a real shame. But thank you. I'll step off the soapbox now.
Oh, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
It's about skin. I've noticed also in that age range where skin starts to become dry and it starts to, I don't want to say sag, but sometimes it gets a weathered look, like it's not leathery, but it's...
Mm-hmm. A lot of that's estrogen. And one of the things estrogen does is it plumps up the subcutaneous tissue. And so as estrogen levels drop, as they normally do, even when a woman is still menstruating, her estrogen levels are quite a bit lower in her late 40s than they are in her early 30s. And so it's a combination of loss of collagen, which happens naturally anyway from weathering, and this abrupt loss of subcutaneous fluid, a drying out of the tissues, so to speak. And so the combination is pretty lethal. Things that you can do, they used to put estrogen creams on the skin, but that turns out to give you fairly high levels of uterine cancer, so that's not necessarily such a good move. But a lot of women who are on estrogen replacement will tell you that when they went on it after having menopause, that their skin plumped out again and that the aging reversed itself. So I think it's fluid.
I see it in men as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. It's and a lot of it is collagen loss, as I said, but there's an abrupt change in women. It's more noticeable because it occurs so quickly. As men, I think it's a much more gradual process, at least my observation is such. But men do also drop their estrogen levels and their testosterone levels as they approach the end of their 50s anyway.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and thanks for giving me an opening to discuss a complex and very interesting topic. Bye-bye. Let's go to Rick in Watsonville. Hello, Rick, and welcome to the program.
Hello, doctor.
Hi.
Yes, I've been having nosebleeds for years now, mostly in one nostril, and sometimes in the morning, just waking up, it'll be a spontaneous bleed, but it's less severe now. But I wondered, at what point do I consider a cauterization in that one nostril?
Oh, I think you're way past the point to consider cauterization. Start with this. Make sure your blood pressure's okay, because sometimes nosebleeds are a sign of high blood pressure, so we need to rule that one out, but presumably you've been to the doctor and that's been checked. The second thing is you haven't any history of abnormal bleeding anywhere else, like when you floss your teeth, your gums don't bleed and you don't get big bruises or anything that would make us think that you might have a problem with clotting, correct?
No.
Okay. Localized nasal symptoms like allergy symptoms or lots of mucus from the nose, congestion, anything like that?
Not really.
Any history of trauma or cocaine use?
Yes.
Okay. So blood vessel damage is high on the list, and where the blood vessels are damaged, they can become, when they regrow, they can become very superficial and even sometimes wider than normal, so they're very easily traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
I usually will put people, after I cauterize them, if I see a look when they're not bleeding, and if I see a big wonking vessel that's juicy and looks like it could easily get hit by just, you know, wiping your nose, I'll cauterize that with silver nitrate, which is relatively easy, and you can get the nasal septum numb so it isn't painful.
Uh-huh.
Then after the cautery, I will put people on nasal estrogen, male or female, because you're not going to be on it for long enough to develop breasts.
Uh-huh.
But the estrogen is fabulous for making skin grow, just in context to our previous caller. So if you put estrogen on your nasal septum, the kind that's designed to be put into the vagina, a little tiny bit, little dabble do you, it'll cause that skin to thicken up and be much less vulnerable to bleeding. And
Great. It's
not a surefire cure for recurrent nosebleeds, but it's extremely effective. And after a couple of weeks, generally the person doesn't have nosebleeds again for a year or so. And if it comes back, you start doing the estrogen again. Don't even need to go to the doctor because your tube is still good and you're going to have way more, even the smallest tube is going to be way more than you'll use.
Right. And you could just treat each nostril individually? And
Yeah, a little pea-sized amount at night, just dabbed into the nostril and mush your nose together just to push it in a little bit. And
right.
Obviously, keep your fingernails short because you might be a sleep picker.
Sure.
Okay?
Thank you, Doc.
Thank you. Looks like we have time for Hal in Santa Cruz. Hello, Hal. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Your discussion about the women and diet and led me to want to tell you about my diet and my concern. Obviously, I'm not trying to lose weight to get into a bathing suit. I have been feeling weak for for many years now, I don't eat breakfast. I eat an extremely light lunch, and by my reckoning, probably eat half as much at dinner as the average person. But you said 8 to 12 hours. Well, I'm clearly going way beyond 12 hours between meals, something often approaching 16 or 18 hours.
How's your weight?
My weight is steady.
Good. Okay. So you have physiologically adapted, and you're eating probably fewer calories than a person of your exact weight and height who ate differently would be able to eat and maintain their weight, but you're in a stable situation, so there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, except that you are probably having less muscle mass than you would have if you had a different behavior set.
Yeah, and that's why I was prompted to call, because I feel weak. I'm still playing baseball competitively with men less than half my age, but I don't hit the ball very far, and I actually recently went to my physician in part to discuss my feeling of weakness.
What I would suggest you do, I have this apparatus in my office because I do a lot of weight control, high-level weight control work with clients, but there's something called a body impedance analysis, a BIA, and you should at least look at your muscle and fat ratios and see whether or not you have a higher or lower percentage body fat to muscle ratio than the means for your age group. It's natural for that ratio, the muscle mass, to fall, in particularly in males as they age, and females as well. And that's just by the law of averages. But it's also not a good thing. It's also typical and natural for people to become weaker as they age and for people to die as they age. And while I can't promise you that you won't die, I can promise you that modifying your behavior would undoubtedly improve your muscle strength and your muscle mass. And you probably do have a certain degree of sarcopenia that has manifested as a result of your habits, despite having good exercise habits and pretty good DNA.
Okay. Well, and my diet is heavy in protein, and I'm vegetarian for almost 40 years now.
Right, but you aren't distributing it well. You dump out the sand and then you fill it back up, and you're in. But if you stop dumping, then you would be in a different equilibrium point and your muscle mass would probably be greater.
My problem is if I eat breakfast, I'm really hungry by about 10:30 or 11.
You're eating the wrong breakfast.
Well, I haven't eaten it in so long. Yeah. Okay.
You're eating the wrong breakfast. The traditional American breakfast, almost all of them have too much carbohydrate in it, and they will increase your appetite. So the trick for you would be to start off with small amounts of protein in the morning, maybe a protein shake, something that doesn't have any sweetener or sugar in it, or some unsweetened yogurt, or a fried egg or something like, or a boiled egg for that matter, a hard-boiled egg, you know, 70 calories of protein, really not hard to just choke it down as if it were a vitamin pill. Not going to give you nausea. You'd start yourself introducing your body to small amounts of protein in the morning. When you get hungry, if you get hungry at 10 o'clock, eat another hard-boiled egg. Treat it as fuel. Don't even worry about it being tasty or anything like that. You're really trying to reset your physiology. It's not about pleasing your palate. Find something you can choke down automatically and start doing it. And I would predict that you'll find that you are still eating the same dinner, not gaining weight, and maybe putting on some muscle.
I'll give it a try. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And I want to clarify, it's bioelectrical impedance analysis. I think I might have said body impedance. That was a misspeak. And we've come to the end of another hour. I want to thank everyone who has participated either by email or by one of their other forms of input, the callers especially. And I want to thank all of you for being part of this hour of Ask Dr. Dawn. And since we have a minute, I want to also put a big thank you out there to my friends who send me reports. Duff Howell and Joe Tribulato are strong contributors to this program. And last, but by far not least, Charles Mansky, my producer, my webmaster, your call screener, and the real brains and technical wizardry behind Ask Dr. Dawn. Thank you, Charlie, for all that you do. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.